Good afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The presidential debates are right around the corner, and the nominees are ratcheting up their pitch to voters in their attacks against their opponents. There's been renewed scrutiny to both the Trump Foundation and Secretary Clinton's campaign. A series of gaffes and relentless and possibly irrelevant questions about health and other shenanigans. We'll try to make sense of the latest polling and talk about some state political news on this week's edition of All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm happy to welcome Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. She's an expert on state and national politics, women and gender in politics, political parties, and public policy. She's also an author whose books include Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America, and Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics. Lily, it's good to talk with you again.
Nice speaking with you.
So let's start with the Trump Foundation. There's been some great reporting out of the Washington Post lately, a lot of investigative stuff. Basically, what it's found is that Trump has found a way to give away other people's money and claim the philanthropic credit for himself. Is that basically what we're looking at here?
Yeah, that's what I understand. It's the dogged reporting by Fahrenthold, I think it's John Fahrenthold at the Washington Post, who's been calling sort of nonprofits and charities, long lists of them, and compiling as much information and data as he can with regard to some promises made by Trump with regard to donations, but also just essentially what famously was the adage from Watergate, trying to follow the money, or in this case, sort of where there perhaps wasn't donations or there weren't donations, and where the money's coming from and where it's going. And it's been a lot of interesting and really sort of groundbreaking reporting in the Washington Post on the topic.
So, other than the people who follow political campaigns, who cares about that?
It does give you some nominal insight into Donald Trump, how he might operate, the way he kind of approaches philanthropy, and also to some degree, I guess, part of what we are seeing with Trump is promises that he makes and whether or not he keeps those promises or abides by them. So some of it is, very much inside baseball, inside politics. But it's also to some degree a picture inside of how Trump operates as a businessman, as a philanthropist in New York City, where there are quite a few people of the same sort of ilk, and to some degree where he has placed an emphasis with regard to his own reputation and how he would like people to perceive him.
I guess the real question here is, will this sway any undecided voters, do you think?
I don't know if it will sway undecided voters or not. It might, because it does sort of flesh out, at least on some level, our understanding of who Donald Trump is. And there's still a lot of information that we don't know. And part of the reason Fahrenthold sort of pursued this dogged kind of investigation was because we have the ongoing request for Trump to release his tax returns, and we haven't seen those tax returns. So we have a lot of information with regard to how Donald Trump classifies himself as a businessman, as a billionaire, as a philanthropist, as somebody who's making all of these donations. And Fahrenthold was trying to essentially put some of the pieces together that were not necessarily linking up, from what I can see, with regard to, the reality of what goes on with regard to, sort of that class of citizen in New York City, and also with regard to Trump as a political candidate.
So let's compare and contrast. There's an academic term for you. This isn't an essay exam, I guess. Let's
I
talk
hope
about.
Not.
Well, I studied enough. It could be. Let's talk about this in relationship to how the whole story unfolded with the Clinton Foundation, there's a pretty stark contrast here, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the Clinton Foundation is obviously the foundation that Bill Clinton set up after he left office. And so this is, you know, not necessarily something that is new with regard to presidents after they leave office, particularly because we've had presidents now over the years who, you know, leave office. They're still fairly young. And they, you know, they try to figure out what to do with the rest of their lives, which is something that Alexander Hamilton talked about in the Federalist Papers with regard to perpetual re-eligibility of presidents, but we do have a term limit on them. So, you know, Clinton, W. Bush, now we'll have Obama leaving office. You had Jimmy Carter after his one term, and George H.W. Bush. And they all left office, and they were in pretty good health. And then they had to figure out, you know, what to do with their name recognition, what good works they wanted to be known for after they left office. And the Clinton Foundation was one of the ways that Bill Clinton, you know, decided to essentially parlay his popularity, his connections with international figures. And it's a foundation that basically set out to more or less, you know, solve a variety of international problems as Clinton himself identified them, or people on the Clinton Foundation board identified them.
But there was a lot of talk about misconduct and inappropriate financial relationships and all of that about the Clinton Foundation. Apparently none of which turned out to be true, but it was still a story that lingered for weeks and weeks and weeks. Compare that to how the whole Trump Foundation thing's being covered.
Well, I mean, I think, again, the with the Clinton Foundation, there was a question of whether or not there was inappropriate access to Secretary Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. The Obama administration had asked for a lot of, you know, sort of separation between the foundation and the government, particularly the State Department, and access to Hillary Clinton. And so the investigation into the Clinton Foundation has, you know, has found that Hillary Clinton had meetings with international figures when she was Secretary of State. And some people had asked for meetings through the Clinton Foundation, but essentially that there wasn't, you know, essentially a quid pro quo, as it were, with regard to what the Clinton Foundation was advocating or people were advocating to the Clinton Foundation for, and actually necessarily changes in policy that were coming out of the State Department or the Obama administration when she was Secretary of State. The distinction is that the Trump Foundation is not necessarily is set up as a straight sort of philanthropy, as I understand it. And I am not an expert on philanthropic law or the particularities of this in the IRS code. But the philanthropy itself is one that mostly solicits, as I understand it, the Trump Foundation solicits money from other wealthy individuals and then distributes it as donations to charity, which is different from the Clinton Foundation, which is, you know, mostly targeting policy areas that they're trying to develop, again, using donations from wealthy individuals or government agencies and so forth, to alleviate a variety of mostly health and poverty-related issues, as I understand it, in the developing world.
You know, and you and I are talking about this, but I keep thinking about that undecided voter out there and whether or not what happens with someone's foundation is a specific thing or if it's just part of a general drumbeat of negative imagery that we get about candidates during an election. And is there a cumulative effect, do you think?
I mean, there may be. And again, it goes to some degree, in the case of Hillary Clinton, there's this question of whether she's trustworthy. That's where most Americans, based on poll numbers, have found that they are skeptical with regard to her trustworthiness. And so the whole sort of swirl of investigation into the Clinton Foundation sort of leans into that narrative with regard to Hillary Clinton. With regard to Donald Trump, the foundation issue doesn't necessarily pick up on, per se, say, some of his Achilles heels, if you will, with regard to what Americans think about him. Generally, the poll numbers have indicated their skepticism with regard to Trump is whether or not he's fit to be president. And so the Trump Foundation narrative and the investigation into it doesn't directly lean into that narrative with regard to the skepticism of his capacity to be president.
Okay, well, let's talk about health. Another issue that's had its moment in the sun in the news cycle. What do you make of all the hoopla surrounding Hillary Clinton's bout with walking pneumonia? Was this an example of gender politics at play here?
Yeah, I you know, as somebody who sort of looked at and tried to unpack some of the issues around gender politics, I would say yes, on some level it is, because there is this sort of presentation of Donald Trump as a virile male. He has a young son. He has fathered a number of children. He presents himself as according to one of his doctors, at least, the healthiest person ever to potentially occupy the White House. There's this sort of understanding or narrative around men who are generally able to continue to produce and reproduce children well into their late 70s, 80s, 90s, sometimes in the case, I think, of Charlie Chaplin. But in the case of Hillary Clinton, you know, she has embraced this sort of title as a grandmother, as she is a grandmother. And then with that, you also have our understanding of women who are older, who are grandmothers, and there's some discussion of whether or not that then makes them look old, frail, weak, as opposed to powerful and sort of younger and demanding in a certain level.
But, you know, I guess, and we're going to talk about this in the next hour, too. Hillary Clinton did something that most Americans do on a regular basis. She went to work sick.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you've done it, I'm sure. I've done it, you know, and you hope it doesn't happen. In my case, I hope it doesn't happen on a day when I have to be on the air. But pretty much every talk show host has done a show when they really should have been in bed. And she went to work and she had walking pneumonia. So how is that different from how most of us behave here, at least in America? It's not like that in other parts of the world.
No, I mean, and she came out after, you know, the couple of days of rest that she had, and she said, you know, that was one of the choices that she had made, and that some that, as she noted, a lot of Americans actually don't have a choice to make. They can stay home and, you know, take a couple days off. A lot of times that means, as she said, that they would lose a paycheck, or, you know, that they really do power through because your job may depend on you showing up every day and getting that paycheck.
So how much do we really need to know, and how much do we have a right to know about a presidential candidate's health records? I mean, is there some sort of formal or informal rule about what should and shouldn't be provided, and who's it provided to, and how can we actually vet that information?
Well, this seems to be a little bit of a controversy these days, too. And if we go back to 2008, you had John McCain, who basically made his entire health history public. And granted, you know, he was running as an older individual, somebody who had suffered from skin cancer, who had been a prisoner of war for a number of years, where he had been physically abused and tortured. And so in order to some degree to sort of combat the potential area that might provide for attacks on him, he basically said, "Here's my entire health history," and so that's not necessarily the norm. Most individuals running for president will sort of go to a doctor, and the doctor will say, you know, this is what this person has in terms of their vital statistics, right, their weight, their height, and, you know, whether they're on sort of common forms of medication and so forth. And that's, generally speaking, what we've seen consistently over the last number of presidential cycles. And there's been some discussion about, you know, there isn't anything obviously required in the Constitution, but we've also had, you know, the famous case of Woodrow Wilson, who had a massive stroke and was, you know, essentially incapacitated for, you know, a long stretch of his term in office. And that was hidden, and his wife was complicit in hiding a lot of that. And so, you know, we have 24-hour news cycles that are filled with speculation about presidents' health and presidential health. And a lot of times we've seen when somebody is in office, of course, they'll be upfront with whether or not there is a health malady. We've had, you know, issues around colon cancer with presidents. We've had presidents getting colonoscopies when they have to be under sedation. And so you actually have constitutional transfer of power for an hour or two while the president is under sedation for those kinds of procedures. And it's about also, you know, demonstrating the kind of health maintenance that presidents say the rest of us should also be pursuing. In this case, I think, and I had heard a proposal that I thought was actually a solid one, that the candidate should go to Walter Reed and have a basically, you know, sort of overall physical, and the doctors at Walter Reed will come out and say, you know, this is our examination of Donald Trump. This is our examination of Hillary Clinton. This is what, you know, this is what we know, and that should be sufficient. And I think that's actually a good and sort of equal proposal.
You know, and the other thing that strikes me is all of the and I don't want to use the word controversy because it's way overused, but the discussion about, for example, Mr. Trump's failure to or refusal to make his tax returns public. If you apply for a job these days, you can expect to get a credit check. Your entire social media history is examined.
There's a background check.
There's a very thorough background check that's actually done by your prospective employer.
Yep.
Shouldn't there be an expectation that anyone who's running for the highest office in the land would have to provide some financial information?
Well, I mean, the criminal background check doesn't necessarily include a financial exploration, but certainly in somebody like Trump's position, where he's also had a number of complicated financial dealings. He's gone through a bankruptcy, not personal bankruptcy, but his company has gone through bankruptcy a number of times. That would seem to comport with essentially what most of us face when we are applying for a job. And, you know, you're in the middle of a job offer. The job offer doesn't usually come until a background check is completed.
Well, and more than that, you can't rent an apartment without a credit history.
That's true.
You know, and that's, you know, if you need an apartment, that's not a trivial thing. Okay, well, let's take a break, and we'll come back. We've got some callers who want to join us. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Is the number you can use to join All Things Political today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. That's a different number than the one you normally are used to using for this program. 800-642-1234. talk@wpr.org is the email address. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll talk about that on the radio. Lily Gorin is my guest. It's All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 19th of September. Lily Gorin is my guest. She's a political science professor at Carroll University. Okay, so Lily, the first presidential debate is a week away. Let's talk about what the expectations are. What are you looking for in this first debate?
Well, I mean, part of it is to see the two candidates together because, you know, they had different debate experiences during the primaries. And so one of the things that will be interesting will be to actually see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on the stage, you know, facing each other. You haven't seen them interact a lot with each other at this point. And Trump mostly was on a stage during the debates with 4, 5, 17 other people. And so one of the questions that political scientists had, at least myself and some colleagues, during the primary debates, was that, you know, he would be on And then he would engage, and then he would disappear for 20 minutes at a time. And in a two-person debate, it's a lot harder for that to transpire, in part because the candidates do have to, you know, they sort of get a time to make a response, and then they respond to each other, and they're facing each other the whole time. And so to see Clinton and to see Trump, you know, essentially facing off and articulating their positions and you know, sort of in a two-person debate on a national stage. I mean, the anticipation is this is going to likely be 70, 80 million people watching it live. It could be some of the, you know, largest ratings in television history.
Hmm. Well, like we say, the debates are right around the corner, and we'll know more after the first one. Let's take some calls. We've got a full batch of phone calls here. We'll go to Colfax first. Willem is on the phone. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you. I just wanted to speak to Donald Trump's candidacy and how that represents our country. I know that he sort of bullied his way into the Republican, to be the candidate of the Republican Party. They tried to control him, but they couldn't. He sort of bullied his way into it by his vulgar remarks, his belligerent comments about all the other candidates. And now, well, I remember when I was in grade school, you know, we used to have a picture of the president on the wall, and I would ask parents, do they want their children to admire this man who has, by his own language, has been vulgar and belligerent and what we would call bullying, taking a fifth-grade attitude toward his opponents, like calling the former director of the CIA a clown. Every living president says he's not fit to serve. And as far as his support for evangelicals, he embodies none of the teachings of Jesus Christ. No love, no compassion, and even he doesn't embody the teachings of the Republican Party. Ronald Reagan said, tear down that wall. Donald Trump says, let's build the wall. I mean, in every regard, he is an embarrassment to this country. And I think that as far as young people, whether they want to vote or they're disengaged, this man, if he is elected, will determine your future. And if that's not important to you, then, I think you're just not a thinking person. This is a national intelligence test. And if we fail, then how is the world going to view us, that we have this buffoon, this belligerent, he's been called a belligerent vulgarian.
Okay, Willem, we get it. I'd like to have the Lily respond, and then we've got some more calls. Thanks for that call, though, Willem. Appreciate it. Lily?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Willem is also addressing, you know, some of the folks who are opposed to Trump, some of the never Trump folks, particularly within the Republican Party. He is the Republican nominee, but the argument that is being made among the folks who are sort of never Trump is that, in fact, you know, Donald Trump does not represent the Republican Party of Reagan, and does act or operate in a way that many people, Democrats and Republicans, find inappropriate, particularly for a candidate for president of the United States.
Well, does the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan even exist?
I do believe that the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan still exists. But I do think that the Trump candidacy is putting pressure onto the party in ways that haven't been as acute in past elections.
You know what this reminds me of, and I don't want to go too far into the weeds on history here, but this reminds me of kind of the way the Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party disappeared after Goldwater.
Yeah, and I mean, and it was the Goldwater election in the draft Goldwater campaign in 64 that really sort of created the party that we know of as the Party of Reagan, because that started the movement within the South, particularly the Southern white voters, to move away from the Democratic Party and ultimately shift into the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And Goldwater consciously made an effort, as he said, to sort of join the libertarian West that he was part of as a senator from Arizona, with the what he saw as very conservative white Southern voters who had been in the Democratic Party for 100 years since the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the Goldwaterites in their move to sort of co-opt or take over the Republican Party from the Rockefeller and the sort of Eastern Seaboard, sort of more traditional Republicans of the time, really did start to build this new contemporary Republican Party that we have now. And I think that, you know, Trump is representative of a dimension within that party, but there are lots of other components and dimensions in the party that are finding Trump not necessarily to be representative of the Republican Party that they have been inhabiting for 40 years.
Well, and thanks for the call. Let's take a call from Milwaukee. George is with us. George, hello. Thanks for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
You bet. I wanted to comment on what I think is an irony. When Hillary Clinton was in the Senate, she was actually given some high marks by fellow Republican senators for working across the aisle. And then again, when she was Secretary of State in Obama's first term, generally the marks that were given to her by moderate Republicans were rather high. And, of course, this is all turned around 180 degrees now that she's running for president.
Mm-hmm. Lily, what do you think? We have a short memory?
Well, I mean, she's running for president. And so in a certain sense, when she's a legislator and she's one of 100, and she did, you know, she did make an effort in what can be sort of termed a Hillary Clinton-esque way to really work across the aisle. She wanted to be able to, you know, sort of not only be one of the Democrats, but also to be a collaborative senator. And I believe her intention in moving into the Senate was to try to work in that collaborative way. And, you know, the same thing with regard to being the Secretary of State. When you're representing the United States abroad, you're not just representing one side of the United States. You're representing the entire country. And she worked with senators across in both parties with regard to representing the United States and the U.S. interests around the globe. But when you're running for president as a representative of one of the parties, then again, we are in this extremely polarized atmosphere in general, and it's a national campaign in the country that is very polarized right now. You know, up and down the ticket, it's a polarized situation.
George, thanks for that call. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the debates for just a moment. I understand that the candidates are preparing in very different ways. Hillary Clinton is busy doing her homework, and Trump is Trump says he wants to wing it.
And it might work for him. That's essentially how he prepared for the debates that he had during the primary. Was that, you know, he sort of has these powwows, I guess, every Sunday night with a lot of the inside folks in his campaign, as well as his children and his son-in-law. And he's not necessarily doing a lot of the sort of traditional practice with a stand-in per se for somebody, for Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think he's doing a little bit of that, but he's not doing the sort of extensive preparations that past candidates have done, and that it from everything that I've read, Hillary Clinton is also doing.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. That's a different number than the one you normally use for the Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-642-1234. Let's take another call. This time it's Daniel calling from Wilton. Daniel, hello.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, it seems like the story about Trump's foundation is really like a tempest in a teacup, and it seems like it does more to reveal the partisan leanings of the reporter than about Trump itself. I mean, like, what's the story here? Like Donald Trump solicited donations from other wealthy folks around him, and then he distributed those donations under his name. But isn't that what happens with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other foundations across the country every day?
Lily, is that how, I mean, foundations collect money, although it depends on the foundation. If a foundation was based on a family, for example, the Ford Family Foundation is based on the Ford family's wealth, and they accumulate more wealth through, they don't spend what's called the corpus, they only spend the interest. How common is the type of foundation that the Trump Foundation is, where they basically are an aggregator of money and then they distribute it in their own name?
I'm going to have to defer to people who study the foundations more than I do. I've just been reading Fahrenholt's reporting on it. And what Fahrenholt has been sort of looking for is if Donald Trump himself is donating very much, if at all, to the foundation, or if he is, in fact, as you say, aggregating other people's donations through the foundation itself.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different kinds of foundations, and I guess, you know, this is one of those things where these issues seem to be tremendously important to reporters. And I'm just wondering how, again, coming back to, okay, so I'm an undecided voter. What is important to me? And that's probably the question that both campaigns are trying to answer, because whoever answers it first is probably going to win. Wouldn't that be the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely correct, is that, you know, if you're an undecided voter, and this election season actually from the polls suggests that there are more undecided voters than there were in the last couple of election cycles. And the polls themselves have been a little bit more volatile. So the election dynamic is a little bit more volatile. So even people who have potentially made up their minds, there may be a little bit more room for movement than has been the case in the last couple of presidential election cycles. And so I think, you know, it's a complicated reporting undertaking that David Fahrenholt has been pursuing, that other people have been pursuing with regard to, you know, fleshing out details about Trump and Clinton. But it's also about the candidates themselves and where they're devoting their efforts. And you've seen in the last couple of days in particular, Hillary Clinton has been sort of talking to and paying a lot of attention to younger voters. A lot of the polls have shown that that's a weak spot for her. And so that she's been trying to sort of connect with younger voters. And she's been having some of her surrogates go out and connect with younger voters in an effort to shore up those potentially new voters in some cases. And you can see the same thing with regard to Trump and some of the efforts that Trump is making with regard to communicating to voters who he thinks may be more disposed towards him.
800-642-1234. Daniel, thanks for the call. 800-642-1234. Let's take a call from John in Shawano. John, hello.
Hello. Great show. Say, I'm so glad the election is coming up soon. I've been following this for a couple of years now, huh?
Anyway. So it seems like forever.
Yeah, it does. It's been a wacky ride, hasn't it? Yeah.
It has.
Yeah. Yeah.
First off, the Sunday, August 28th, Doonesbury cartoon by Gary Trudeau before the debates. Everybody should read that or view it anyway. And my topic actually changed a little bit since while I was on hold. But would you have access to, I'm sure you do, international polls about how other people beyond the United States of America actually view this election process? Because Donald Trump is just the absolute epitome of an idiot, and even worse. I sell some things on eBay around the world, and actually have corresponded with a few people from Germany, Norway, and Australia, and they all are just amazed that this is getting to this stage. I believed in the dumbing down of America for many decades, but if Trump is elected, this is the worst thing for America. Not that, it is just going to, Bush was bad enough, GW. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we get it, John. We got to go because I want Lily to have a chance to respond to that, and then we need to get to a break. Lily, what about the international view of Trump? And again, does that matter here inside the United States in our little news bubble?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of the polling houses these days are polling specifically in the United States because we are the people who are going to be voting in this election. But I do know, I had students who are abroad this summer and some colleagues who are also abroad this summer. And everybody that I've spoken to, they said that they spent the entirety of their time abroad, whether they were in Ireland or Germany or Spain or in China, that people wanted to talk to them about the election. And so, obviously, the United States is a very important country with regard to our economy, and our politics affects lots and lots of other places. I haven't seen any specific polls of citizens in other countries. But the reports from my students in particular, they started school a couple of weeks ago, was that, they spent a lot of time when they were abroad with people asking them lots of questions about this election cycle.
800-642-1234, the number to call. We have a number of callers to get to when we come back. We're going to take a short break. Lily Gorin is with me as we talk about the most current political news. You can join us at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn, today on the Ideas Network of WPR. This hour, it's All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen today and tomorrow. Kathleen will be back on Wednesday. Lily Gorin is my guest. She's a political science professor from Carroll University. So let's take a quick hit at state politics before we move back into presidential stuff, because I don't want to let this go. It's a huge, it was a huge issue last week when it blew up, and it's still reverberating around the state. Last week, of course, The Guardian, a British newspaper, published leaked records of the John Doe investigation. What did we find out from the leak? How embarrassing was it for Scott Walker and GOP legislative leaders?
Well, I mean, the leak was has a cache of emails and correspondence that, indicate the connection, or at least the pursuit of financial support for Scott Walker when he was facing the recall in 2011 and 2012. And it, it shows that he sort of went out and asked people for money, and that the Wisconsin Club for Growth, which was the third party organization that was essentially used as the sort of receiver of the funds to help advocate for Scott Walker's response to the recall. And there were very large donations from any number of people. And that was legal for the most part, as I understand it. And I am not an election law expert in any way, shape, or form, John, so you can't hold my feet to the fire here. That it was legal because of some of the decisions that have been made around the Citizens United case. And so what's coming out and what's, what is sort of casting a shadow is that a lot of the folks who donated thought that their donations would be made in anonymity because of some of the protections under the Citizens United decision. And the result of the leak is that we now know who a lot of these people were who donated to the Wisconsin Club for Growth.
Well, the whole Citizens United ruling, well, not the whole ruling, but a major piece of the Citizens United ruling rested on the idea, as propounded by the majority in the Supreme Court decision, that there would not be collusion or cooperation between these third-party groups and actual candidates. And so they said, okay, so they're not related, they're not talking to each other, they're not coordinating, and because they're not coordinating, this is all okay, it's okay to have all this dark money and all of this secret money involved in political campaigns because there's no coordination. The big discussion after this leak of some 1,500-plus documents, emails, and even canceled checks, is that, okay, we had coordination going on here, and doesn't this make the Citizens United ruling look bad?
Well, I mean, and that's potentially where the Supreme Court, in fact, is going to decide whether they're going to take this request to hear about the reopening of the case. They may make that decision this week or next week, and that it may actually prompt the court to reconsider aspects of the decision made in Citizens United. The particularities of the law are fairly complicated, and so the solicitation of funds is not necessarily, working collaboratively. It is a sort of
This is also about tax law, too, because you have all these 501c fill-in-the-blanks out there, and each one of them has a different set of rules, and some,
are advocacy groups, and some are education groups, and some are overtly political groups.
You need a law degree.
Exactly.
Neither one of us has one, so let's move on. One thing that kind of surprised some people was that this wasn't a bigger story, particularly given the suggestion that that state laws were rewritten based on a $750,000 campaign donation from a company that sold lead paint.
And again, there may be an advocacy for another investigation to come out of some of the documents that were leaked. Of course, the issue of the leaked documents is that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin had said that the documents should be sealed, and so that their leakage itself may be, again, illegal in some capacity.
Well, the Speaker Voss said he wants an and Majority Leader Fitzgerald in the state Senate both want investigations. The Democrat says, we want an investigation too. Like, we'd like to know how the earlier leak happened, because this isn't the first time the documents have been leaked in this John Doe investigation.
Right. It's a very complicated situation. And if the Supreme Court does decide to take the case this week, I'm not exactly sure, what parts of it they're going to pursue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move back. We've got full phones and everybody wants to talk presidential politics.
Okay.
So let's take another call. We'll go to Glidden, Wisconsin, home of the Glidden Black Bears, I believe. Greg, you're in Glidden. Good afternoon. Thanks for calling the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, John and Lily. How are you today?
Hey,
great.
Greg.
Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, I agree with your first caller. Well, that Mr. Trump is... says I'm fit to be the president of the United States. So I'd like to know, why is this foundation held to a different standard than the Clinton Foundation? Why is this foundation?
Okay. All right, Greg, thanks for that. He agrees with the first caller we had on, that Trump is unfit to be president, says he has no compassion, and wants to know why his foundation isn't subject to the same kind of scrutiny as the Clinton Foundation. It appears, thanks to Washington Post, that perhaps it is.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing both the Clinton Foundation and the Trump Foundation being investigated and analyzed by various members of the press to see what they do and who donates money and how that money sort of makes its way through those foundations and where it ultimately goes.
Mm-hmm. All right, Greg, thanks for the call. Let's go to Mike in Wisconsin Rapids next. Mike, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Go ahead.
Hey, John, Lily. I'd like to know about the income taxes of both candidates, Trump and Clinton. Like to know if any external government forces are acting on their behalf. And I'd like to know why the commissioner of the IRS, John Koskinen, hasn't even come out and said, yes, we are auditing Trump, or maybe they aren't. And why isn't that audit being expedited to completion, if there even is an audit? But it seems to me like Trump could dance this all the way into November and not actually even an audit whatsoever. Like to find out, more from the IRS itself, where they stand and why they haven't completed this audit.
All right. Mike, thanks for the call. What do we know about that?
Well, I don't know particularities with regard to audits, and I do think that they are not necessarily public. So it's up to the individual, I think, and I could be wrong about this, that the individual has to sort of say, yeah, I'm being audited, or no, I don't believe the IRS sort of says, hey, this is who we're auditing. And I believe that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have made their financial, their tax documents available, I think, since Clinton was actually running for, Bill Clinton was running for the governor's office in Arkansas. So I believe that pretty much there are 30 years or so of their tax documents that are available publicly. And I know this is one of the questions that a number of reporters have been asking Donald Trump, or at least sort of tweeting it out every day, that they've been sort of asking for Donald Trump to make his tax returns public. He hasn't done that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike, thanks for the call. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to point out that the allegations of coordination are there, not just because Walker was very active in the solicitation and knew directly who he's soliciting to in many cases, but they were also coordinating the message these funds were used for, in some cases giving an up or down on various videos that were sent out, and specifically to make sure that it had the right message. Mm-hmm. And these were people who worked both with Club for Girls and Walker's campaign at the same time.
Nate, thanks. Thanks for that call, Lily. A lot of that stuff is now legal under the changes made to campaign laws in Wisconsin in the wake of this John Doe investigation.
Yeah, and I believe that's correct. And I think that some of the decision also with regard to Citizens United had made that area, the issue of coordination, one that was not as clear cut as it had been before, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Nate, thanks for the call. Let's take another. Let's talk vice presidential politics here for just a moment. The vice presidential candidates are largely invisible to the news media. We don't get a lot of coverage of what they're doing. They're out campaigning for their surrogates for the top of the ticket. What do you think so far of the way the vice presidential candidates have been used in the two campaigns?
Well, I mean, they're kind of being used in the traditional way that vice presidential candidates operate, that, you know, there's big splash when they're chosen. They get their day of the sun or their night of the sun at the convention. They introduce themselves to the American people because usually they're not as well known as the folks at the top of the ticket. And then they, you know, then they do operate as surrogates. And we've seen Pence in Wisconsin a number of times. And I think we've seen Kane here once or twice. And I do believe that Scott Walker is standing in for Kane for Mike Pence's debate preparation.
Okay.
And you know, and they're operating as surrogates, and they're not necessarily making a lot of noise beyond that. I think that Pence has a particularly clear directive from the Trump campaign, which is to, you know, try to connect with GOP voters who are not necessarily sold on Donald Trump. And Kane is as operating again in a very sort of traditional vice presidential way as a surrogate for Hillary Clinton, particularly over the last week when she took a couple days off the campaign trail because of her pneumonia.
We're almost out of time. It's been a tough couple of weeks for both campaigns. You had basket of deplorables, and then you had Trump once again, according to some, hinting that that someone might assassinate Hillary Clinton, saying her Secret Service or her protection details should disarm themselves. So it's been a tough couple of weeks for both candidates. How would you advise them in this home stretch of the election? What do they need to do? More importantly, what do they need to avoid? What's going to resonate with voters between now and the election?
Well, what's been surprising to me in the last couple of days, actually, is the Trump himself reviving the birther issue, which seemed like a really unexpected move by Trump, who had been gaining in the polls. He's been gaining in the polls. And this was a kind of return to, you know, sort of talking about things that are more fringe elements and that don't necessarily reflect clearly well on him. And, you know, he said he put it to bed, but it's been the sort of the conversation among, you know, a lot of reporters and in the news over the last couple of days. And so in that regard, Trump has sort of had been more or less on point and on task. And this seemed to be a deviation. So if one were advising Trump, one would suggest that he sort of get back on his script and sort of not deviate to these kind of not as clear directions.
What's in about 15 seconds, what's Hillary need to do?
Hillary needs to connect with voters who are skeptical about her, and those include millennials in particular.
Okay, we're out of time. I'm sorry. I wish we could have another hour. There's plenty to talk about. Always a pleasure to talk to you,
thanks,
though.
Thanks, John. It's great
thanks
to
for
talk
being
to
here.
You.
Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. Joined us today. This program was produced by Scotty Myers and KP Whaley. Thanks so much to them. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around. More to come after the news. We're going to talk about sick leave and working while you're ill. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.